The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 6, our series on health professions education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblind, joined by my co-host, Dr. Mike Cheng. On today's episode, we had the pleasure of sitting down in person at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine AIM Week 26 in Seattle to discuss navigating clinician educator careers and ways to develop a meaningful and successful career. Before we get started with that, Mike, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Yes, sounds good. So we are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have such a great conversation with our guests where we will review take-home points from a few different workshops at AIM Week 2026, the National Conference of the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine, that relates to how to plan for a successful and sustainable career as a clinician educator.
We have Dr. Tina Fan, who is an assistant professor of medicine and hospitalist at the University of Pennsylvania and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, presenting on behalf of Drs. Carly Fortin-Leung, Nicole Namor, and Desiree Burroughs-Ray from their workshop, The Clinician Educator Hustle, A Roadmap for Your First 5 Years.
We also have Dr. Elisa Sotil, who's an associate professor of medicine at the University of Florida, associate program director for the IM residency, and assistant dean for medical education, presenting on behalf of Drs. Elaine Cruz, Katie Guylison, and David Vermenti from their workshop titled Job Crafting for the Clinician Educator, Applying Organizational Psychology Strategies to Cultivate Meaning in Work.
We had a really great discussion. I think you'll really enjoy hearing some frameworks of how to think about transitions in your career, how to frame your goals and focus of what you want to achieve as a clinician educator, and how to build your mentorship support and thinking about ways to really flourish in medicine. So I hope you enjoy. Great. Well, we're so excited to sit down in person here at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine AIM Week 26 here in Seattle. And thank you both for taking the time, Dr. Tina Fan and Dr. Elisa Sotiel. Is it okay if we call you Tina and Elisa today?
Absolutely.
Yes,
thank you.
Please.
Great. Well, we'd just like to start with some casual rapid-fire questions just to get to know you a little bit better. Tina, can we start with you? Could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself, maybe include something from outside of medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Tina. I'm a proud MedPeds hospitalist. I'm a mom to an almost 2-year-old, and I am a wannabe food connoisseur.
Lovely. Do you have any favorite foods, any great foods that you got in Seattle this week?
Oh, actually, yes. There is a great pastry place that I went to yesterday by Pike Place. I think it was Me Some Pastry, so that was delicious.
I might have to check that out. Yeah.
Sounds tasty.
And you, Elisa?
Yeah. So I'm happily married for 30 years this month, have 2 kids, and became a grandmother 3 months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. When not, you know, being a physician, I really love to get out in the garden and just, I live in Florida and it's hot, but I don't mind 90 degrees and being out there. And then one of my other favorite things is watching my family get to eat the things that I like to bake.
Any favorite things that you like to bake?
Believe it or not, bread. Just good old bread with a good crunch on the outside and nice big holes on the inside so that when you eat a sandwich, like the cheese goes through and gets all over.
I'm already hungry.
Yeah, it's making me hungry too. Well, we want to ask how your experience thus far has been overall at AIM Week. Anything surprise you? Anything you've learned? Any kind of takeaways more broadly since you've been here?
Yeah. You know, AIM, I was just talking about this with Molly, actually. And we, this week at AIM, you know, the educators here, everyone is friendly. Everyone has things to share. And the receptivity of spirit is just amazing. It's just such a fun place to be with like-minded individuals. Every session, I've learned something new.
And I think same for me. This is my first time at AIM, and I feel like it's been awesome to, one, see old friends, meet new people, and then also just being around people who want to teach, who want to learn. I think one of the things that was interesting, I believe Sunday, there was a workshop on gamification that was led by the Rising Chief Residents. And although it was meant for other residents, I was like, I still want to go and learn and just get ideas. And so I thought that was really fun.
Totally. I think those chief residents are so impressive sometimes, just they're amazing speakers and bring it all together, even though they're so early in their careers. And yeah, I love coming to AIM Week because it's... you know, we are all educators and passionate about teaching. And so, you know, you go to some other conferences, and maybe I won't name them, and the content may be great, but the delivery is really lacking. Whereas here, people are really motivated to make it engaging and be great teachers. So, yeah. Well, we're today talking about career development for clinician educators. And I'm just curious about what kind of led you to want to speak about these topics here at the Alliance and kind of what made you passionate about this.
For me, one of the reasons I wanted to do this, so your listeners can't tell that I'm a little gray around the ears. So I've been in practice for close to 30 years now. And part of my desire to talk about this and mentors, because I didn't always have the guidance to help me along my career. And so I want to try to give to others who may also be seeking support in advancing their career. There's so many different obstacles that sometimes get in our way as early educators, and sometimes we're not even quite sure about the path we ourselves want to take. Having somebody to help kind of get you to reflect and think about your career choices is very helpful. And so that's why I'm passionate about it.
And I also echo that. I feel like my excitement for this workshop really came about from experiencing the hidden curriculum myself. As a more junior faculty, I learned pretty early on that even though we're trained as clinicians during residency, we're not really taught exactly how to have a sustainable career as an educator. And for this workshop, I was hoping to help others find a more strategic roadmap in terms of how to honestly thrive and not just survive. We don't want to be just like floating, and we want to be swimming and happy.
Great. And I think it's so great that we have such a diversity of perspective from both of you, you know, someone more junior in their career, but someone more senior in their career as well. So, looking forward to our discussion today. Shifting our gears to the case from our fictitious Kashlak Memorial Hospital. So we have Andrew, who's a third-year internal medicine resident. He is nearing graduation and preparing to transition into an academic role at his institution, balancing both outpatient and inpatient care with teaching and professional development. While excited, he feels uncertain about his career direction since he enjoyed many aspects of residency but hasn't identified a specific focus. He meets with his mentor, Catherine, an accomplished and fulfilled educator, to seek advice on navigating his early career. So assuming you are Catherine in this situation, what's coming up for you in terms of what you would suggest for Andrew to reflect about to figure out what he wants in his career? And maybe we'll start with Tina for your response.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things to note is that our priorities tend to change throughout life. Maybe what you thought your career would look like during residency may not be exactly the same as maybe a couple years down. If you are a parent, your priorities tend to change. So I think finding that happiness in your career is pretty important.
Yeah, I think that's so important to find a career that is not just interesting, but also fulfilling, and finding that happiness that you're mentioning too.
And I think one of the real pleasures of academic medicine is that your career does often shift pretty significantly throughout that time. And yeah, as you said, you may not be able to visualize that in advance, but it makes it, you know, fun and interesting to be able to keep evolving what your interests are and what your focus are and build more skills. So I'm excited that we'll maybe get some more support in crafting the careers that are most fulfilling and best for us. Tina, in your workshop, you talked about the concept of ikigai, which is roughly translated as a reason for being. This is a concept introduced to our listeners earlier in one of our more popular episodes, number 36, where we also talked about early career development. So we're happy to revisit this topic. Could you help explain kind of how to use this tool and like how it helps you think about where to focus your career energies?
Yeah, absolutely. So just as a refresher, ikigai is a Japanese concept. So it's essentially the interaction with four circles. It's kind of similar to a Venn diagram, but essentially it includes what you love, what you're good at, what the world needs, and what can you get paid for. So I think that for Andrew, once he starts his career, he's going to be bombarded with a lot of opportunities, whether it's emails, just things to sign up for, committees, projects. And that can quickly be very overwhelming and honestly can lead to burnout if he's not happy or passionate about his projects. I think ikigai helps you to find that sweet spot. So where your interest actually aligns with your career path. And I think once you find that ikigai, you can find true meaning and longevity in your career. Yeah. So I honestly just hope that Andrew just sits down and just thinks about what he loves most about medicine and what can he get paid for, because we do need to be compensated.
Yeah, and I really like the structure of it, too. As someone who appreciates structure, be able to kind of go through that process, think about those four different circles, I find that quite helpful.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things to think about, too, is that when you're looking at the framework for ikigai, you can always revisit that at another point in life. We kind of talked about it earlier, but your priorities change, and so maybe your interests may also change. I, as a resident, did not understand the concept of having a leader who's in operations. Maybe that's something you can explore if you're interested in. So,
And wanted to open the space also for Elisa, if there's anything you want to add to kind of how you thought about career, how you would advise someone as they reflect upon the career, what they want.
Yeah, I think, you know, for Andrew, he's not yet experienced really the other side. You know, residents, they're in academic medicine because they're in training, but they're not on that side that we as clinician educators are. And so I'd encourage Andrew to, before jumping in, as Tina was talking about, you know, to different things and committees and, you know, maybe getting in over his head, to think about in his role as a resident physician, you know, what are the things that really gives him joy, you know, what aspects of his day-to-day already as a resident that he does that are so motivating to him. And then that can kind of help him frame what he looks for. Now, there may be a lot of things that he hasn't had experience to. Tina just talked about operations, but it can give him a building block so that when he starts his next phase of his career, he at least has that foundation of things he already knows that he enjoys and provides fulfillment. And then he can add to that with time. But I encourage all, you know, residents, early career physicians to realize that there is time. You don't have to do it all in your first 1, 2, 3 years. Take time to explore different roles and find out what really helps bring you joy.
And I think I also echo what she says, because I think that as all of us are very strong individuals who are, you know, amazing go-getters, we probably want to see like what's next, where can I succeed? And I think the important thing to remember is that your main role is being a clinician and being a great person, of course, but you don't always have to get to that next step in your career, or how you define success may be different from another colleague. And so I hope that people don't compare themselves to their colleagues. That's all. Mm.
The thief of joy comparison. Yeah, I think as you both were sharing, I was just thinking about how academic medicine is such a marathon, not a sprint. And kind of thinking about that longevity is so important and not burning oneself out too early. Yeah, just having that in mind as well. So Andrew has now transitioned to a new job and finds attending life to be very busy in different ways than residency. While he appreciates the better hours of the clinical work, Now there are a lot of onboarding things to complete. There's CME, there's meetings to attend, paperwork to fill out, et cetera. Like Andrew, I think many of us relate to wearing many hats and having a long to-do list. What strategies would you give him to help him stay productive?
Yeah, absolutely. So honestly, in this day and age, we probably all have very short attention spans thanks to social media. And to get back-to-back credentialing emails, worry about licensing, DEA, like you mentioned, and then also just navigating life, especially if you have to move to another city. And even if you don't have to move to another city, just life in general happens even while you're working through your career. And so it's really hard to stay focused. And so one technique that I really like is the Pomodoro technique. And essentially, it's you set a 25-minute timer. Within those 25 minutes, you do uninterrupted work. Put the phone away unless your work, you know, is on your phone. But ideally, put yourself on Do Not Disturb and just really focus on your task. And then after that, you take a 5-minute break, well-deserved. This is considered a cycle. You can do a couple of cycles based on your bandwidth and time. And then at the end of it, you deserve a much longer break than just 5 minutes. I think the key here is to not try to tackle your entire to-do list, because we all have a ongoing running to-do list that seems like we can never really accomplish at all. But I think if you can set yourself up for success and just try to tackle one or two to-do items on that list during your 25 minutes afterward, you can hopefully regain some sense of control and feel satisfied that you were able to complete the task.
I like that, because definitely my to-do list is never ending. And I think I can use a lot of mental energy just sort of thinking about the to-do list. And 25 minutes feels very doable. So just kind of saying, you know, I'm going to dedicate this time and maybe at least knock a few off the list and take down that mental load.
Can I add a helpful hint maybe? While doing that 25 minutes of uninterrupted time, you know, shut the Outlook down. Or whatever email server you use, because I think we all have that tendency, you know, as Tina mentioned, to try to multitask and do things. Just close the Outlook, because the email really is so pervasive. And I think that's a big part of what drains many clinicians, is that incessant email.
And Teams messages and
Slack.
Pages, yeah. And Slack and Wilson. Yes. Tina, your team also talked about the Schlossberg's transition theory to help in life transitions, and definitely moving to a new role, transitioning from a resident to an attending, or even mid-career attending, transitioning to a new role. How do you use that to think about sort of framing transitions?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Schlossberg's transition theory, or the four S's, I kind of use as a reflective tool. So it includes situation, self, support, and strategies. So of course, as you mentioned, for Andrew, he is transitioning from being a resident to an attending, and that's a shift in autonomy, change in responsibilities. And, you know, with that, during that chaotic period, how can he use certain strategies to navigate that? You know, I think it takes some self-reflection, but what can Andrew use to support himself? Is it, who can he turn to when he just needs someone to talk to? How does he typically cope with things? Does he like to go into problem-solving mode? Or does he just need a good vent session? I mean, we all can use some time to just like normalize our frustrations to our friends. And so reflecting on those things and knowing how you like to cope, I think, is helpful. And the other thought to mention too is that with this theory, this transition theory, it can change and match your new reality too. So with any transition in your life, you can always sit down and just think about the things that would be most helpful for you.
So in terms of these four S's, mm-hmm. how would you suggest people kind of practically do it? Is it like sit down, think about the mm-hmm. different categories, reflect in that regard? How have you used it, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, when I was first starting at Penn, I was a new attending and then also a new mom. I remember I was 3 weeks postpartum when I moved. And so at that time, I had to look at my support group. It included family, friends, and honestly, my mentors. I think I always thought that your relationship with your mentors is a professional relationship, but I learned in that time that a personal relationship, you can definitely build that with them too. And one of my mentors is a mom physician, and just asking for advice from her, I think, was helpful in just normalizing breastfeeding at work. That was one thing. So that is like looking at your support network. And then for me, strategies, I think it's very hard going home to a newborn. I felt like, though, that when I did go home, I was able to recharge my battery whenever I had quality time with my family. And then I felt rejuvenated the next day to be a better person, clinician, and educator. So I think that's how I coped using this transition.
That's great. I feel like transitions are so hard in life, and or I guess for some more than others. I think for me, I definitely relate of, you know, transitions take a lot of mental energy, take a lot of effort to plan around and to plan for. So, I really like this, again, structured way to think about it.
And Elisa, any thoughts that you have about techniques that you use to try to be more efficient and effective, or how you manage transitions and supports to get you through those?
Something that I learned over time was communicating with folks on my team about my time. We talked about electronics. And so as a practicing clinician, the MAs and the nurse in our clinic, they send messages through our EHR and expect that I had the EHR open and I would respond right away if something important, critical was happening. And so that led to like always having the EHR open. And then I realized, well, wouldn't this be better if something really is critical? You know, you have my cell phone, right? Our faculty, all the cell phones are available. And, you know, telling my team explicitly, you know, if it's important and needs to be handled right away, call me, immediately. And I shared with them because, hey, I'm not in the EHR all the time. I have these other jobs, these roles that I need. And so that gave me then the permission to shut the EHR down for a period of time so I can work on those other tasks, you know, with less interruption. So talk to the people on your team, and it may even be your admin team. Some people do have more than one admin role. I do. And so I have different administrators with each. And so coordinating with them, hey, you know, can you leave this part of my calendar free, because this is going to be admin time X, and talk to the other admin and leave this part free. And so really communicating what your needs are as a clinician educator so that your team knows that you're not just, you know, ignoring them, blowing them off, but that you're there doing other important work.
I love that. I think that's huge, because I think also with mentees, you know, sometimes I'm really good at checking email, but I ignore my team's messages, or I'm really good at responding to texts, but I'm not as on top of my email. And kind of having those discussions up front to say, like, if it's this kind of problem, it would really be best through email. If it's this kind of problem, it's really best on the phone. And setting that clear expectation can be super helpful.
So in academics, there can be some unspoken rules for adapting to new environments. This is a question for both of you. Can you explain some of the unspoken rules you followed as you adapted to various new or maybe a same academic environment with a different role?
I think I'll start. So an unspoken role that, or rule related to a role at our institution related to how inpatient rounds were run. When I came in as a new faculty member, I was young, I was female, and many of the other clinicians at that time were opposite of those two things. And generally speaking, rounds were sit-down rounds, card flipping for 90% of the rounds. And so the residents kind of expected that from me, and I found myself slipping into that same pattern. And it was with a lot of angst that I was like, well, do I really have to do it this way? Can I do what I think is the appropriate thing to do, which is do bedside rounds as a predominance of my rounds? And so it took, I felt, at least for me, it was a big courageous thing to do because I was going against the majority at that point. And so I encourage all of you, you know, as you're in your new roles, you know, there may be unspoken rules, hidden curriculums, if you will, I encourage you to use some fortitude and do what you believe is best for your patients and best for your learners, and what helps, again, allow you to maintain your resilience and flourish.
I like that. I think it's both that concept of observing the hidden curriculum, but also knowing where your boundaries are in terms of what you're comfortable with, not letting the hidden curriculum drive you in that sense, but also kind of having agency and a say as you engage the hidden curriculum.
I think that was really powerful. I was actually going to say to observe the hidden rules, mainly because I felt like when I was stepping out of residency, I was like, how do I set myself apart from others? And, you know, in the world of med ed, I can say I'm interested in med ed, but really, how do I stand out? Because it's so saturated. So I feel like the unwritten rules, the hidden curriculum is very different at every institution. So I think I just want to encourage the audience to really spend your first few months, even the first year, just really listening and being open-minded to what others have done. And think about if you're, you know, again, when it's time for you and you're interested in a certain role, think about what the person who's already had that role and achieved it done. Because they probably did a lot of work behind the scenes that we didn't know. I feel like for one of the things that I learned is that consistent visibility is key with med ed. So if there's going to be lots of opportunities, but emails sending out asking for volunteers to facilitate an H&P or for someone to help mentor students, I think that it goes back to Ikigai, so you have to be interested and passionate about it. If it's within your bandwidth, I would recommend signing up for it, because I learned that, again, consistent visibility is part of the hidden curriculum. And so as you're volunteering, the med ed leaders are going to start recognizing your name, and then they're going to be interested in seeing who you are, putting a face to a name. And maybe in the future, if a role opens up, then they may think about you, and that could be a potential opportunity.
Those are great suggestions. Thank you. And you kind of mentioned looking at the people who have been in those roles before, and sometimes those can be great mentors. And in our case here, Andrew has already reached out to Catherine to sort of build his mentorship circle. Are there other ways that you would recommend an early career physician kind of build their mentorship support, and how should they use that best to advance their career?
I think that before you seek out a mentor, I think in this case, Andrew already has a mentor, but I hope that Andrew can reflect on what he needs from a mentor. That's something that I didn't really do initially, but I think that everyone's mentor-mentee relationship is very different. And so how does Andrew feel best supported? You know, in a crisis or a chaotic period, does Andrew need a little bit more hand-holding? Like, hey, please, can you tell me what's the next step I need to do? Or does Andrew just need a little bit of encouragement, a little guidance on what is the next step or phase in his career? So I think, one, as a mentee, there's definitely some accountability and responsibility on your part to say, like, okay, what do I need from my mentors? What am I looking for in a mentor? And then I think that from a mentor's perspective, there are definitely certain roles, I would say, that hopefully can be fulfilled. That's different for everyone, like I mentioned, but I feel like you definitely want to find someone who can help you, again, tell you the unwritten rules, tell you what not to do, explain different personalities within a division, someone who always seems to know the different opportunities out there, who's doing what, and can hopefully help you seek out different opportunities. And then I think someone who can also normalize your frustrations, help you find that safe space where you can talk. Even though those are lots of roles, and that's a lot of pressure to put on one person, even though those roles can be fulfilled by one person, it's actually encouraged, I think, to find a diverse team, because having more than one mentor can give you a broader perspective. And I think that in the end, it's helpful because you can get different advice from different people and see what you can actually take from it to help jumpstart your career.
Yeah, I like that thought of just, you know, it being a great network of people that are there to support you, not just one person, but, you know, multitude of people, each giving their own strength. So,
Yeah. And then I would also encourage people to look outside of their institution, because if you've trained at one place, med school, residency, and then new attending, you're used to a certain way, but meeting somebody from another institution can hopefully shift your mindset.
Yeah, I really wanted to echo what Tina just said, but even not just outside your institution, but outside of mostly general internal medicine, one of my most valuable mentors was actually from a different department, and someone I connected with just surreptitiously after, being at a meeting together and realized that this individual had a lot of similar interests and was passionate about education. And so we got together. But also Tina's point about, really knowing what you're looking for, to really take the time to reflect within yourself and think about your own needs before seeking out mentors. But it doesn't always have to be a seek and find. Sometimes it just happens, like that example I gave you with the pediatrician.
Well, that's great. It's so wonderful when those things happen surreptitiously, like you were saying. I'm kind of curious if there are other people, as you think about your support network you've built over the years, how you've met them. Were there some of them that you were, seeking to fulfill a role in your life or meet that need in terms of a question you had?
So I was fortunate to get involved with a educator society, hopefully okay to say SJIM, and was not expecting it to be such a rich experience with people and connections. And, we talk about, near peers, and those kind of relationships were really the ones that helped me grow most, not only, career, but grow as far as thinking about new ideas, new ways to express myself as an educator, and thinking about new ways to get involved with my learners as well. So having that societal network, I think, is also really important. So encourage your listeners to think about, getting involved in different ways and other things, community networks, other societies, local medical societies. The network that we could tap into is so vast.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I'm always so impressed. Clinician educators just, we want to mentor and teach and share. And so I'm always very thankful of, when we reach out to people like you and you're happy to volunteer your time. And I would say it's almost never that people say no to, an opportunity to collaborate on something or, give a little bit of support or share their expertise. And maybe they don't have the bandwidth to be your longitudinal mentor over time. But, I think most clinician educators are willing and happy to support others. And so it can be hard. I'm kind of an introvert. And so just getting out there and, reaching out to somebody that you don't know can be tricky, but I think it often can be very rewarding. Before we kind of move the case on a little bit, that Andrew's, a little bit further on in his career, looking back to when you were in your first couple years of academic medicine, is there anything that you sort of wish you could tell your younger self before you got through those first few years, or life lessons that you wish you had known then?
So what I would tell my younger self, I would have liked to look outside of my institution earlier. Back to Tina's point, I think that's so important, not only to get different ideas, but again, to build that network of mentors, support system. And also, when we deal with systems issues at our workplace, it's often similar to systems issues at other places, even though those institutions may be funded differently or, have different levels of prestige. We find when we talk to our colleagues that they're often going through very similar struggles somewhere else. And that can really just be, not that we want everyone to struggle, but it can be really affirming to know that we're not in this alone. And it can also really begin the impetus for looking at ways to solve some of the issues that are setting up these struggles.
And I think for me, I think a lot of things that we said earlier, I definitely think is helpful in your first few years and honestly, any time in your career. If I had to look back, I think that I would just put less pressure on myself and just realize that everything happens for a reason and it's going to be okay. I think as a new mom, a young mom, I felt like I wanted to still do everything. I was like, okay, I'm a mom, but I still want to be a physician. I still want to be an educator. I want to do this, 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 and this. And you certainly can. But I think it goes back to doing it on your own timeline when you feel ready and when you feel like you have the most support. Because again, in order to raise a kid, it takes a village. And so when you feel like you have the bandwidth to do it is important.
Yeah, I really like those tips. I think as someone more junior in his career, I definitely loved having that support network of peers and near peers. And then also just really knowing that I don't have to do it all at once. You know, I think those are such key tips. So thank you for that.
And if we kind of move the case on a little bit, and Andrew's now like 3 to 5 years into his academic career, and he's feeling confident with his clinical work. He's doing some educational projects that he really enjoys, but he's starting to think about, you know, how do I shape my career into maybe a funded role, maybe protected time to be able to do these things? How did you navigate that journey early on? And Elisa, maybe we can start with you.
It can be challenging for anyone, and it's very variable from institution to institution. Because some of those roles that one might be interested in may come with financial support, where there may be a buy down of your FTE. Some are roles that are in name only, and you're expected to do additional work, but finding the time on your own. So I encourage, you know, your listeners to really be mindful as they're seeking out new roles to think about, or to find out what exactly the support looks like, because it will be different from institution to institution, and sometimes even within a department itself, there may be different support if you're a subspecialist versus a general internist. So look into the role, be open-minded, but if there doesn't seem to be the support that you think you would need for the role, because it's always important to think about why you want to do something, you know, what's the why behind that interest. Think about why you can make it happen, like why you're the best for that role. And then think also about what you would need to be successful in that role. And don't be afraid to ask, you know, if it's not a currently supported role. Ask why maybe no one had ever asked before. As strange as that may seem, I've heard cases of that. So ask for the support. Maybe it won't be, you know, a 0.3 FTE, but maybe it'll start with 0.2, which is, you know, better than nothing.
And I think for me, a great advice that I received is, so when there are calls out for a leadership role, whether it's a sub-I clerkship director or, again, an operational role, I think that as a more junior faculty, Andrew may feel some sort of imposter syndrome, like, do I have the skills to take on said role? Are they just going to choose a more senior faculty? And the advice that I got was to just go for it and apply if you're interested in it. And honestly, even if you don't get it, because the worst thing they can do is say no, right? I think that when you submit your application, there's going to be a committee, and within the committee, there are going to be leaders, and they can, again, start to recognize your name. And then also that's a chance for them to review your CV and recognize all of your previous and current accomplishments. And even if you don't get that role, you may be better suited for a different role. And down the line, as you're exploring, the leaders can also think about you too.
Mm-hmm. And I think that really ties in with what you said earlier about mm-hmm. being there, kind of increasing your visibility. So mm-hmm. people know what you're interested in. Then people can think about you for future things as well.
Put yourself out there.
Yeah.
Within reason.
Yeah. And one thing I'm kind of curious for some of these roles, there's a call out for a specific role. Sometimes I wonder, how do I know whether this role will be fulfilling? How do I know whether this role is something I would want to continue long term? You know, that type of question about the future of like longevity as well. How do either of you or both of you think about that topic?
So I think what can be helpful is to talk to individuals who have held that role before, if at all possible. And again, this is where cross-institutional collaboration can be helpful if you know others who have a similar role in a different institution. Talk to them as well. Get an understanding of what is really fulfilling about their role, as well as the obstacles that they face. And you may find great help looking outside your department internally as well. So similar roles, like there's clerkship directors in surgery and peds, there's program directors in all these different departments, associate program directors, core faculty, like talk to others in your institution, but in different departments to learn more about the role so that you can get things that perhaps you might not learn from within your own department.
And I think that speaks to the importance of that, building your network and also those professional societies, how they can help with that as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And then to add to that, I think that it's very important. It's almost like doing your homework to try to see how much you can know, because knowledge is power. Sometimes, though, once you step into a role, there are still things that you didn't know were part of your job description. I think that it takes time to reflect, like, there are cons in every role. Is the worst part of your job something that you can live with every single day? Like, are you still happy with it? And I think there's also pressure to continue with a role. And of course, you want to finish the role until there's, you know, another person who can take over. But I think it's also okay to take your mental health into consideration. It's like, okay, I think I'm good at it, but this role may not be something that I think I can continue based on what's going on in my life. And take the pressure off, and it is okay to step down as well as you're exploring different roles.
Thank you for saying that explicitly, because I think sometimes we do get, you know, we get in the wheel and it's hard to get off. And so having that ability to reflect and respond is really helpful. And Elisa, in your workshop, you talked a lot about flourishing. And I think that sort of gets to that of if you're in this feeling where you're in a role where you're feeling stuck and unhappy and maybe burned out, how do you pivot that to really having a career where you can flourish? Or what does that even mean to have a flourishing career?
Yeah. So flourishing is, you know, it's not a new concept, probably as old as Aristotle when he talks about eudaimonia, which is good spirit. But more recently, Vanderweil kind of brought this concept to the 21st century. And flourishing is not just about happiness. Or satisfaction. It involves, you know, physical health, mental health, virtue, character, having relationships that are meaningful and close, but also, you know, back to what Tina was saying, you know, meaning and purpose, finding that meaning. And if you're in a role where that meaning is kind of being hidden or shoved under the rug, stepping away is one answer. Another solution may be thinking about the elements of that role, because there was one point in time where you still really liked that role and wanted that role. So what are the different elements? And that gets a little bit into what our workshop talked on was, you know, crafting and looking at the different tasks in your role, almost an inventory of the different things that you do, the purpose behind them, and thinking about, you know, that thing that may have really drained you before, that task, is there a way that can be modified and adjusted so that it's draining less? Where also those other tasks on your list, is there a way now that you can amplify those to really restore the meaning in that role that you had initially sought out? So there are options, and sometimes it may mean leaving, but job crafting is a way of like reframing and relooking at your position to think about each element and its values.
Can you think of some examples when you've been able to do that in a role? Are there like...
Yeah, actually. So job crafting is not a one-time thing. And so I've applied it a few times over my career. I'll give an example of when I was in my clerkship director role. maybe it was still, I think, within the first year. I was really excited to take that role. I love educating. You know, that's why I'm talking to you today. But realized within a short period of time that something was draining me. And it was when I would have to reach out to faculty to share with them that, you know, if one of the student evaluations had come back and there was a concern raised or a criticism of that faculty member. And so it was getting to the point where when, you know, I would send an email to faculty, like they would know immediately, oh, Elisa's sending me an email. What did I do now? Right. And that was hard and it was draining and it was not part of what I really thought about when I had accepted the role. So looking at that part of my job, how can I reframe it? What part of listening to the student evaluations and acting on them, could I adjust? Well, I found a way working with our admin team to get information about the positive things that our faculty and residents were doing sooner so that now I could start reaching out to our faculty and residents quickly about, you know, the positive student comments, you know, tell them about the difference that they were making in the students' lives. And so that really helped reshift the balance of that role for me.
So that sounds like kind of a cognitive crafting, that you're sort of shifting the focus of that task. You still need to do it, but you're able to put a more positive spin on it. You also in your talk talked about task crafting, sort of focusing on the tasks that you really enjoy the most, and then also relational crafting, kind of changing the nature and relationships, which sounds like that example also was a relational crafting of being able to have them not see your emails and get a negative feeling immediately. Are there any other relational craftings that you've done in your work to try to make your job more fulfilling?
Yes, actually, an example, more recent relational crafting. So I redid my crafting list in preparation for giving this session a year ago, in fact. And at that time, when I did my first iteration of relational crafting, so just to tell your listeners what that means. So when we talk about relational crafting, it's creating this inventory of all the people that you work with, as well as the type of interactions you have with them. And so I had created this list. And when I went back a second time, because I always encourage folks to go back and relook at their lists, I went back and realized that I hadn't listed my co-faculty for my division. And I was like, oh, how did that happen? And so I got them back on my list. And so one of my goals after doing this was to think about how I could work to rebuild relationships within my own division. And one of the things I intentionally went out to do was to seek out my co-faculty just to get in touch with them socially again, because that was something that I had let slide. And so with those interactions, actually began learning more about what they were doing in their work life and their research, and actually recently collaborated with a colleague on a manuscript that we put out together. So those things like revisiting, you know, job crafting is something you'll do time and time again, but it really helps, again, to get us to revisit valuable tasks that we may have, revisit relationships that we may have let go. It's just a great way of helping us to find our joy again.
I'll revisit this podcast episode when I'm feeling a little down and need some advice.
I think as you're sharing, I just think about the importance of community, you know, as you're going through whatever it is, whether it's a struggle or just normal everyday life, just importance of sharing it with others, whether it be for some productive output, or even just for, you know, having a chat in the hallway, you know, having things that uplift your mood throughout the day, for sure. Wanted to turn it over to Tina in terms of, you know, as we talk about relationships, community, relationship crafting, whether you have any thoughts in terms of how that worked out for you as you think about flourishing at work.
I think one of the main things that I realized was that I could actually have a personal relationship with my colleagues. I think I like initially thought that I had to have a wall, like be very professional at work. And you do have to be professional, but some of your personality can also come out. You can talk about personal things at work just because life does happen outside of medicine. And I think that's really helped me. And I also didn't realize, and we kind of touched on this, but like how impactful just even small casual conversations could be. And I felt like having just a conversation with my mentor led to this actual workshop meeting. So even just being like, hey, I'm interested in this, and then finding that shared common interest could lead to a very meaningful experience. And I think also just realizing the importance of collaboration. Of course, you can just have one or two people leading a workshop, but it goes back to having more people getting to know others and getting more perspective, I think, is really helpful and has honestly helped me flourish.
Amazing. Well, these have been really helpful tips, I think, focusing on your passion and your meaning, finding your ikigai, thinking about how you can build that mentorship support, that mentorship circle, both inside your institution and more broadly, and then thinking about job crafting to create kind of a role that really works for you and brings you joy. If you feel comfortable sharing, has there been, if you think back over your career, has there been a time when you felt burned out and like, were there any other techniques that you use that help you get through that? Or was kind of one of those that we already talked about really the most powerful, and how did you use it specifically?
I have had burnout in the past, for sure. Multiple things coming together at once, and we talk about the concept of flourishing and those different elements. And I think as clinicians, when one of those aspects goes away, that leaves us in jeopardy of burnout. And for me, what had happened was I no longer felt supported in the role that I had been given. And so that kind of knocked the legs out of everything else in my life, family. You know, it's hard when you don't feel like you're being valued at work. It starts to spill over into other things. And so very quickly, your support system kind of gets rocked. And that led to, I won't say burnout again, I will say to a lack of flourishing. And it led to a lot of introspection, and was a point, Tina mentioned earlier about stepping back from a role. I didn't step back, I was removed. But in fact, it actually was a really positive thing for me because I was burnt out. And so having that happen, while as life-shaking as it was at the time, really allowed me to move on in my career and to later flourish.
Yeah, I think for me, I definitely felt a little bit fatigued and emotionally drained during my first year out of residency. And I think it more just had to do with a combination of like life and work and services and really getting comfortable in my new role. And I think what helped was also advocating for myself. If there was a service where I really felt specifically trained, I felt open to talk to my leadership about that and to maybe advocate for less time on that specific service, or honestly, just home life, just advocating for more help at home. I did not grow up with having cleaners come to the house, but now I'm a huge advocate for that. And so I think anything that you can do to get some of the pressure and work off of like your shoulders, I think can help. And then because of that, hopefully you can find some time to reflect and think about what brings joy for you, not only professionally, but, personally.
I'd like to add to one thing, because Tina mentioned early being a young mom in her career. And I also had my kids early in career, and I suffered with postpartum depression. And I just think it's important that all clinicians, all who are listening today, really realize that as physicians, it's educators, it's really important that we're able to talk about our mental health struggles openly, so that our learners, whether residents or students, et cetera, they really can understand that it's okay to have those struggles themselves. Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, with flourishing, mental health is a really important part of the ability to flourish. So if your mental or physical health is suffering, you know, flourishing is not going to occur. So please be models, those of you who are suffering with mental health issues or physical health issues, be models for your learners as well.
Well, thank you so much, Elisa. I think that's such an important point to make, how people shouldn't suffer alone and they should share and really seek out help when they need. But also to be aware of others too. You know, when you see others struggling, when you see signs of it in others, just check in on your colleagues as well. I think those are so important to remember.
And I think reflecting on both of what both of you said, you know, we are humans and people as well as doctors. And I think sometimes when we get in kind of the academic rat race, it's, you know, we're very focused on job burnout and like, what about my job do I need to fix? But really, we are humans in our home at home and our life outside of work. And those all interplay together with your flourishing, that we can't flourish at work if we're not flourishing at home, and we can't flourish at home if we're not flourishing at work. And they all tie together. So
any take home points that you want to really drill in for our listeners?
I think for me, one is that it's okay to take time outside of what you're done with residency to really think about what you want. But as you're doing that, you can also explore different interests. So I think that's one. And then I think the second one is, I can't emphasize how important it is to have a great support system. And just, again, not just in your personal life, but professional life. I think that I always had the potential to do great things, but when I met my mentor and had this mentorship, someone who could guide me, I honestly felt like that's when I flourished. I felt like I could take my potential and really showcase it. So can't emphasize that enough.
Yeah, Tina's point really is important. I think it's just beyond like the professional mentor, having that support network, whether it's family, friends, your religious community, your social circles outside, maybe it's your church group, et cetera, or the community that the place you shop, you know, having people that you connect to really helps keep your life balanced. And to Molly's earlier point, you know, about flourishing at home and flourishing at work, work is just part of life. And so I try not to say, you know, work-life balance. I like to think about life, and that within life we find balance, and that just allows for flourishing to occur.
Well, thank you so much. Both really great take-home points, and I thank you both for such a rich discussion. At the end, we always give our guests a chance to plug something they're working on, a recent publication, an important resource. Wanted to give you both that opportunity.
Oh, sure. I had the fortune of working with a great group of collaborators from different institutions, and we had a grant through the Change MedEd from the AMA, and that we're looking at the use of a web platform supported by AI to do asynchronous coaching for learners and faculty. And it's really been kind of neat to see how that's changed how individuals seek coaching and how it's helped them to really work on their own goals and advancement. So something fun we're working on. So more to come about that in the future.
Is that publicly available, or you're just in sort of a research phase at this
Not
point?
Yet publicly okay. available.
Okay, well, share it when it is. That sounds exciting.
Be on the lookout.
Stay tuned. I would say something that I'm working on is a framework for thrombocytopenia. And so I'm producing that episode with Corey M. I think that's something that I can geek out about and nerd about, because it goes into, like, we have our traditional framework of, like, you know, what are the etiologies, you know, increased destruction, you know, decreased production, whatever, but creating a slightly more innovative framework for it. So stay tuned. That should hopefully be coming out soon. I don't know when yet, but. And then I believe in the power of manifestation. So one of my goals is to actually make, hopefully, a guest appearance on every podcast platform that I listen to as a trainee. And so Curbsiders was one of them.
Okay, and well, so I'm gonna very pleased to allow yeah, you to manifest.
So, you know, I'm just gonna hopefully
keep
going
through.
Keep going. Yeah.
I love that goal. Amazing. Well, thank you both so much. This has been really fun. And yeah, lots of great pearls and much to ruminate on.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was such a great episode, Mike. It's so fun to sit down in person with people here at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine and just hear from different perspectives and really reflect on career development and how to kind of optimize your career in academic medicine. And I think for me, a big take-home point was the structure of job crafting. I hadn't really come across that specific structure of trying to narrow down sort of changes you could make in your job in terms of task crafting or thinking about if there's a way you can change sort of the specific tasks you're responsible for, relational crafting of building those relationships to make your job more satisfying, and cognitive crafting or sort of shifting how you're looking at the tasks that you do. And I just think it's a really nice framework to kind of come at your career role from multiple angles and hopefully try to optimize those for flourishing. What about you? What did you take home from this talk?
Yeah. I think for me, I really like the different structured ways to think about whether it's job or transition. I know Ikigai was what we talked about in this episode and the prior episode as well, but just having a way to think about, you know, what gives you joy and meaning and what, you know, the different categories that one should think about whenever you're considering a role, a job even. And then the Schlossberg's transition theory, just having those different buckets of things to account for as you think about transition and the things you need for transition. So I really like that. I think it's helpful to have those structured ways to reflect just to make sure you're not forgetting anything and that you're really accounting for essentially the things you need. So really like the discussion as well.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. And thanks to Dr. Ira Krishnovskaya, who couldn't be here today, but is helping support us, and to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support of this project. Thanks to the team at Podpaste for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I've been Dr. Mike Chang. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.